I'm going to call this meeting to order. This is the House State Affairs Committee, Thursday, March 21st. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Madam Secretary, could you please call the roll?
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Ledoux?
Here.
Representative Story?
Here.
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Co-Chair Fields?
Here.
Co-Chair Price Tompkins?
Here.
Thank you. We have a quorum. Everyone's here. Please silence your cell phones. Thank you, Representative Tarr, for being here. On the agenda today, we have House Bill 20 and HCR 4. We're going to start with House Bill 20, Sexual Assault Examination Kit. So, Representative Tarr and Ms. Andrew, if you want to come to the podium and discuss your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from Anchorage.
For the record, Stephanie Andrew, aide to Representative Tarr.
Thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill back before you. What we are going to do, as I understand it today, is go through the changes in a committee substitute. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if you want to make a motion to
it. Yeah, let's go ahead and adopt that at this time. Mr. Co-Chairman, do you have a motion?
I do, Mr. Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee adopt as a committee substitute version 31-LS0253/G as the working document.
Seeing no objections, the motion is adopted. This is the third hearing in House State Affairs. I think so. With that, we'll go to Representative Tarr and Ms. Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to do is walk through in the same way we did before the presentation, and it will serve as sort of the sectional analysis and update as to the changes that are in this version of the bill. Shouldn't be any surprises, because in the first presentation on the bill, there were a couple of items that we had mentioned were in discussion and getting some additional feedback on, and so you'll see that the changes reflect the connection of that information into the bill. So we won't go through the background. We had talked about that. But then transitioning into sections 1, 2, and 3, we had talked about last time the language that the drafter had used was, if you were going to consider it sort of a standard, it said that the person should know or reasonably should know. And when we had talked to the alleged legal drafters, they said that was a common standard that was used. But in consultation with Department of Law, it's not that that's untrue, but that what is more consistent with the statute is using what's an existing statute for the criminal law section in the definitions. And so there's sort of four phases, if you will, of mental state as it relates to criminal law. And they're separated by the important terms that are highlighted there: intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or criminal negligence. And what had been suggested to us before was to use the reckless disregard standard. And so this is really the number three that we have highlighted here, and just underlined a couple of, I think, the key points of the phrase or the definition there. So when you act with reckless disregard, and so putting this in the context of a sexual assault, 1, 2, or 3, so it'd be either 1 would be penetration, 2 and 3, sexual assault, that's contact. The person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk. And that kind of behavior would constitute a gross deviation from the standard of conduct that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. And so in consultation with Department of Law, what we've done then is update in the first three sections of the bill from the words "or reasonably should know" to the words "or recklessly disregards" to be consistent with the standards that are currently used in criminal law and illustrated there in that definition section. So I don't know if there are any questions about that, but I will just continue on. Then the other big part of the original version of the bill was addressing the definition of consent. We have pulled the sections related to that out of this bill for further consideration, and Co-Chair Chris Tompkins and I discussed this yesterday when I had an opportunity to fill him in, that the implications of this are very far-reaching, and it represents a cultural shift, really a lot of significant work in the last couple of years with the Me Too movement and, you know, a lot of discussion in our culture about what consent means. And if you recall in our first meeting, we talked about right now we have it defined as without consent, and it's consent, so it's more in the context of something being taken away than in the context of affirmative giving consent. And we talked a little bit about the STAR priorities, where they had been modeled after Montana law, and some other advocates had also suggested Minnesota law as a place to go. And so what we want to do with that, and perhaps even in with this committee, what we talked about is just slow that piece down a little bit and spend some more time so that when we do this, we really know that we've captured everything. We did capture the part about expressing overt, affirmative action, right? So overt actions that express consent. But there's some other sort of pieces of that definition that we want to spend a little more time on. For example, in the Minnesota definition, they talk about if you were previously engaged in a relationship, you know, that doesn't imply consent. Is that something we want to use? There's also language in another consent definition that says, you know, that consent can be given and taken away all in the same sexual encounter. That may be something for consideration. There's other statutes that in their definition of consent talk about physical state or being physically incapable of giving consent. So those pieces of it we're going to continue working on, and so that part has been removed from the bill. So that removed not only that section, but then there were two sections in the crimes of public administration that related to failure to report a crime against a child and failure to report a crime against an adult. Those, as well as the Military Code of Justice, all are about the consent definition. So those are all set aside for now. So then what remains is that first part, and then the parts that are more closely related to the rape kit reform. So that takes us back to what is now Section 4.
Could I jump in there?
Sure.
I guess I would like to see something in writing from a prosecutor saying that the recklessly disregard standard is going to be adequate to prosecute someone who rapes someone who's incapacitated for whatever reason. It seems like recklessly disregard, just at a really cursory reading, is a fairly high standard. What if an inebriated person rapes someone who was incapacitated? Is it reckless disregard if you yourself are inebriated? It just seems like a very high standard, and I would hate to have too high of a standard kind of render it less effective in application. So I think we should just have confidence that the language is adequate. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but the previous language seemed pretty strong, and I just don't want to. I understand we want to be careful, but I don't want to water it down too much. So, mm-hmm. Hearing from prosecutors that it'll work would reassure me. Mm-hmm. Ms. Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have concerns kind of along the same lines when I see a lot of the wording change from who to when. When the offender knows. What if they say, "Well, I didn't know"? Then what? Does that automatically make the crime not a crime?
So through the chair, and if I can address both of them. So to put this into context, this conversation generated out of redefining sexual assault in the second degree. And and you probably don't have it right in front of you, but in the statute where it talks about this, I just want to be specific to putting this into context. So the way this reads for sexual assault in the second degree, an offender commits the crime of sexual assault in the second degree if, number one, the offender engages in sexual contact with another person without consent of that person. But then what number two says is the offender engaged in sexual contact with a person, A, who the offender knows is mentally incapable. So what we're doing here is we're not taking any of those words away, but we're adding to it. So it's who the offender knows or with recklessly disregards. So we're adding to that. So I don't think it will have the impact that Representative Fields was just mentioning, although I know it's not happening at today's hearing, but we absolutely do want you to hear from Department of Law. That's why we've been working in close consultation. And one of the challenges with these particular crimes, the sort of he said, she said, or two individuals with competing stories, is don't want to have the bar so low that it gives too much opportunity to not prosecute, but not so high that that standard can't be met. And so we're really trying to strike the balance there. But I would absolutely feel more comfortable with having Department of Law, which I think is in the next meeting plan, describe that. And I don't know if Representative Vance, if that helps with your question as well, to be putting it into context with that language. I think sort of more clearly defines the circumstances in which it's going to be applied.
It seemed like the previous version of the bill was updating what seemed like a pretty anachronistic definition of consent regarding intercourse with children. Why would we not kind of update that anachronistic language?
Mr. Chairman, we are working to update all of those sections, and so they're all going to come back together.
Okay.
So it'll be the failure to report on the child, the adult, the military code of justice, and then the overall definition of consent. And want to do that at the request of Mr. Skidmore. When we worked with him, he feels, you know, he's been able to do some research, but every word is so important in terms of the implications and how it'll be applied in a courtroom. And I want to make sure we get it right, because it's big. It's really big, and it'll be a significant accomplishment on the part of the legislature to update those statutes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So moving on then to what remains here in Section 4. So this, again, we had the requirement to do three things in here. Send the kits to the crime lab within 30 days of collection to be tested within, it was 6 months. We've changed that to 1 year. And that victims be notified within 2 weeks of receiving the results. So all of that remains. What's different is we went from 6 months to 1 year. And I think if I was in charge of everything, we would have a 30-day standard. That is the best practice that states are trying to move towards. When we started working on this 4 years ago, it was taking 18 months. So we have significantly reduced that. We're on average now down to 10 months. What we have to make is a policy decision, and why we've changed it to 1 year in this version of the bill is you should have the fiscal note. And so under the six, if we want to meet the 6 month deadline, it will require additional staffing. And that, again, would be a policy call on the part of the legislature. I support that as an important improvement to public safety. I don't know if there's enough support to add those new positions at this time. The crime lab folks in consultation have said they can absolutely meet the 1 year, and we left it in the conversation that we're going to continually push them to be doing that in a shorter time interval. But again, we have the fiscal note, and the whole purpose of starting out with a very aggressive timeline for me was very intentional, because I wanted us to get the fiscal note so we could look at that. Because if you remember in the first presentation, what I was saying, I think we have sort of a fundamental question about what means justice. You know, what is justice for a victim? How long should they have to wait? And so as we're trying to improve our system, which we are making improvements, which is positive, we're not to the point where, you know, it is only taking 6 months, or it is only taking 30 days. And so what we can do with the existing staffing is meet a 1 year deadline. And if we want to do something different, then we'll need to add additional staffing to accomplish that.
On that point, I would actually be interested in what other committee members think. I think a year is too long. 6 months, frankly, is too long. But I'm curious what my colleagues think. I would prefer to pass a bill with 6 months, and just would want to do what the consensus of the committee is. So, Representative Story.
Yes, I think I too would like it to be a shorter time frame. I think it's important that we have the information about how much would that cost, how much staff, and what would a fiscal note would be that to move it to 6 month timeline. I also, and I was trying to remember if this comes in later, but what I think is so important is that the person who is waiting to hear that they are kept abreast of what is happening and informed about the timeline, whatever it is. So I'm trying to remember where that is in here, and maybe I'll ask another question later about that. Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I obviously want kits tested as soon and quickly as possible. Not knowing the exact workload that these people have, it's easy for us to sit here and go, let's do 3 months, let's do 100 days. I mean, it's sort of arbitrary at some point. We don't know what the workload is. We don't know what kind of extra staffing they would need. I'd have to hear from, you know, a lot of state agencies have been cut for many years now, and so their productivity has gone down. So for us to arbitrarily just throw numbers out, I think, is irresponsible. I'm not saying we don't need to put a rush on it. I'm glad. I know there was a time it wasn't happening, so I definitely wanted to go faster than what's been going, but to just arbitrarily cut a time and cut it in half or cut it in half again, I think is...
Well, it sounds like I don't know if that's something that the folks online might be able to address, but first, Representative Vance had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's exciting to hear that the department has been trying to expedite this process the best that they can and have made such big improvements. I think it would be beneficial for us to know what the fiscal note, what the demands of the department are, but also that this is only one piece of that justice system, and just because this may be get a shorter time frame doesn't mean that the other pieces of that will automatically be quicker. And I think it would be good to gather as much information on the whole picture as we can of what justice would look like in a case like this, and make sure that we're not pulling funds from one thing that are artificially injecting something that isn't affecting the whole piece of the pie like we would hope.
Representative Christ Hopkins.
Thank you. I have the benefit of being able to look over your shoulder and see who's online, and yeah, I see.
I was going to go to them next.
Could we ask these questions or ask DPS Crime Lab to speak to bandwidth capacity?
Yeah, Mr. Canaris and Ms. Collins, if you want to weigh in on this question of what it would take to go from a 1 year to a 6 month time period, and whether there are additional nuances in there in terms of. I remember last time we talked about different groups of these kits and which one should be tested first, and maybe it's possible to have a six-month standard for some. Just weighing in on that would be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and if I could just please interject, I apologize because I thought we had included this, but we didn't include this fiscal note. But we do have the fiscal note for the six-month deadline. It's $662,200. And if those individuals could speak to that, then that would be helpful.
For the record, I'm David Canaris, the Assistant Chief with the Department of Public Safety Scientific Crime Detection Lab. Yes, we do have the fiscal note in for four positions, which is what we estimate it will take to meet the turnaround time of 6 months. We recognize that 6 months is also a significant amount of time for kits to be set around, and we would like to be getting ahead of that eventually. But right now, we are around a 10-month average turnaround time for sexual assault kits. So we would like to create a dedicated sexual assault team whose only function is to process these kits as soon as possible. And to do that, we're going to need three forensic scientists and one forensic scientist supervisor position to deal with all of the case management and associated case information and details that come in.
If you're on speaker, please take it off speaker and speak directly into the phone. Thank you for that explanation. Do other people have questions following up on that for the crime lab staff? Okay. Thank you.
And just, Mr. Chairman, if I might, on the fiscal note, and we'll absolutely share this copy now that this conversation's happening, the estimates that they had one forensic scientist, three forensic scientists, so that was the team he's referring to. The staffing cost is about $453,200, and then the necessary consumables associated with timely testing for an additional 120 kits is $122,000. So that's where you get that number. Now, again, would support spending that money and think that's absolutely the direction we should move in. But if we're not going to also appropriate the $600,000 to do that, then, as you heard from the crime lab folks, the 1 year is where they're at right now. I did want to mention to Representative Story's question about victim notification. We're going to get there in just 1 second, and so I'll come back to that. And then Representative Vance's comment, very, very appropriate about the other pieces of the justice system. We had made a number of cuts over the last year. At one point, the Department of Law, for example, was down 27 positions. We know as a result of that, about 7,000 cases went unprosecuted over a 2-year period. They prioritized during that time homicides, sexual assaults, and sexual abuse of a minor. So those, you know, horrific crimes were not being set aside, but it happened at the same time that Anchorage had a spike in homicides. And so the reduction in staffing, the increase in what are more difficult cases to try resulted in, you know, things moving into more like a 2-year time frame. And so there are other pieces of this that absolutely will impact things. But, for example, last year we added back 5 more prosecutors, and I think I haven't been able to follow as closely, but I believe there's a few more positions coming back in. So
that's,
you know,
that's correct. In the subcommittee judiciary budget, yeah, there are additional prosecutors, is my understanding. Representative Ledoux could probably speak to that in greater detail.
So that should help, but, you know, all the pieces, yeah, it'll take all those pieces. Okay, if we're okay to go back to this slide, so that was the 1 year, and then it's been really helpful to be working with other folks and making some good suggestions. Minnesota had a section in their statute, and we have added this in as the new Section B, that the crime, criminal action cannot be dismissed if the deadline's not met. So that was a concern. If somehow, for one reason or another, the crime lab falls behind or a law enforcement agency doesn't meet a deadline, you know, could there be some impact on the case in a negative way? So this would clearly state that that is, would not happen. And then item C, if a case is resolved before a kit is tested, then the timeline doesn't apply. And that was brought to our attention as what would happen in the context of a plea deal. So we have those in there. And then the next two sections are just adds in the language that you're going to have to add the reason the kit was not tested. The first section is about preparation of that report, and then the second section is about delivering that report to the legislature. And then this is the part, we had talked about this the other day. We had some words that were a little more generic or general in nature. These are the actual words that are used in the SAKI, the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative reports, for why a kit wasn't tested. And so now we'll just have the language will be consistent with what they've been doing. And so apples to apples, we'll be able to compare them. So the scientifically unviable, of course, what we had said in the previous version was improperly collected. Right, same idea, but again, more generic. Doesn't meet eligibility requirements or was collected from a person who wishes to remain anonymous, and we had talked about that with the anonymous versus law enforcement reports. And then the applicability, again, is just after the effective date, and then we move the effective date up to 2021, thinking about, you know, if this bill were to get through this year, what timeline would people need to make adjustments, and felt like that was more reasonable implementation date for that. Again, thank you so much for the opportunity to present this the second time, and hopefully those changes have been explained well. And Representative Story, on your piece, the victim notification thing, we've struggled with how to address this. And in fact, in the original version, they talk about their software. I think I had mentioned that their software, and it's set up like any other, you know, database where you have a secure login. And then once you logged in, now all of the rape kits have a unique identifier. You could, you know, use that unique identifier to track it. That costs about $100,000 a year to purchase, and then it's almost $100,000 a year to maintain that database. That's a lot of money, and we, over the last few years, I actually had tried to work with the state of Idaho because at one point they had developed a database that they were going to share with other states. They've since changed their mind and want to charge for it. And so we've tried to find ways to be sort of cost-effective with that piece of it. And so part of my thinking was that becomes less important if the timeline is truncated. So if an individual knows that within 6 months the kid is going to be tested and within 2 weeks of that they're going to hear from law enforcement, you know, we've given them some certainty to the timeline in which they'll be waiting. But now we've extended that to a year, so it's a little bit longer. And so it's trying to figure out, you know, if we're going to spend some dollars, where do we want to spend them? My preference would be on the staffing piece of it first, because then we evolve the system so that the notification becomes less important because it's happening in a much more timely fashion. So that's what I was hoping to get to, is that it's not taking so long that that becomes quite as important. If someone has to wait over 2 years and you think about calling law enforcement and retelling the story 4, 5, 6 times, that's terrible and it re-traumatizes the victim. But if someone has a much shorter time period to wait, then we were hoping, you know, that would sort of make having a database a little less important, but still we have the section that requires law enforcement to notify the victim within 2 weeks. So that's sort of the balance there, but we will absolutely share the information. In fact, it was an Alaska company that developed some software. The Department of Public Safety's had a presentation on how it works. I think they really like it as far as functionality. It's just the expense associated with it and where can we spend a few dollars and what's the highest priority for those dollars.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
Yeah, I appreciate the information. I think it's important for us to think about that because it is very important that people are informed timely what's happening.
And I'll just state, and again, my sincere apology that we didn't include that earlier fiscal note, but the first year cost for the software is $135,000 and then $85,000 annually thereafter. So it's quite a expensive endeavor for that piece of it.
Okay, so we're going to be hearing about this bill again if members don't have additional questions right now. Thanks, Representative Tarr and Ms. Andrews, for coming in. We're going to hold the bill at this time. And next, we'll have HCR 4, Uniform Rules, Committee on Committees.
Thank you.
Thank you. So Representative Kreis Tompkins and his staff will be presenting this bill to the committee. We'll take a brief at ease while they get ready. Thanks. We're back. Representative Kreis Tompkins and his staff are here to present HCR 4, Uniform Rules. This is the second hearing in House State Affairs, so I'm hoping we'll be able to report this bill out. Does the sponsor have remarks?
Not particularly, Mr. Chair.
Great. Are there amendments?
Yes.
Representative Vance. And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Work with me here. So I make a motion to move on the amendment to HCR 4.
I move amendment number one.
Amendment number one. Sorry. Didn't.
Thank you. Would you like to speak to your amendment?
In looking at this this bill on the uniform rules, I think this is good to be compliant with our actions in the legislature, and I'm in agreement with the recommendations to have at least 5 but not to exceed 25%. But upon reflection of the requirements for our standing committees, the minority is entitled to the number of seats that is proportional to the number of minority members, and I thought that it would be equitable to include the language on line 12 that includes the committee on committees to that proportional arrangement, so that it's not just reflected in the standing committees, but the committee on committees that determines who the members are in the standing committees. You know, our democracy is designed to protect the voice of the minority, and I think that it would be good that we reflect that in our conduct in legislature in every aspect. So that's why I've proposed this amendment and hope to have support from members to include this line.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Vance. I've objected for purposes of discussion. I guess I'd like to hear from the sponsor about your take on this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Vance, for the amendment. A couple of thoughts. I'm opposed to amendment number one, not necessarily because I'm opposed to the sort of sentiment behind amendment number one, which certainly resonates with me, and I think I've sort of long felt that greater equitability in the legislature, including its governing rules, including staff policies, staff pay policies, so on and so forth, makes a lot of sense. I think it's a lot of room for improvement. But that's another subject. The primary reason is this concurrent resolution was developed in consultation with the leadership of House and Senate, and it just has had a sort of intentionally narrow and prescriptive approach, and because there's alignment, don't want to add on additional changes to the uniform rules beyond conversations I've had with House and Senate leadership. Beyond that reason, which I think is probably the foremost reason why I'm cautious about amendment number one, is the committee and committees is really such a sort of different animal, if you will. It doesn't have any policymaking power. It's entirely appointed by the presiding officer, be it the president of the Senate or the speaker of the House. And there's effectively no deliberation whatsoever that occurs by the committee. The committee's usually, its meetings are, you know, less than 5 minutes. It's gavel in, gavel out, and, you know, that's the wrap. So I sort of understand on a sort of almost symbolic basis the importance of minority representation. It's worth noting the Senate, the minority leader sits on the Senate Committee on Committees. That doesn't happen in the House. I don't think it has happened in the House for a while. Reasons I think we just kind of have sort of made our own tradition for whatever reason. But I'm not sure there's sort of a lot at stake, I guess. So I think I'm cautious about the amendment foremost because of the alignment behind HCR 4 right now with those in House and Senate leadership. But sort of beyond that, I think it might be more of a sort of symbolic gesture, albeit one I'm sympathetic to, than anything else.
Okay. Do other members have comments? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to refresh my memory, Representative Christ Tompkins, the previous statute said the Committee on Committees was to have 5 members, but currently we have 7. So we're sort of breaking our own rules. So you're just saying at least 5, so that by having 7, we're not breaking the rules. Those 7 can be all majority in the House, which is what they are. And in the Senate, I don't know how many are on that committee, but they allow 1 minority member. Is that correct?
That is correct. And to add on to that a little bit, the presiding officer appoints the entirety of the Committee on Committees. So Senator Giesel, the presiding officer in the Senate, appointed Senator Begich to the Committee on Committees.
Oh, and how many on their committee on committees? How many members total?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, excuse my lapse of decorum. There are 5 members on the Senate Committee on Committees.
Thank you.
Well, I not seeing other comments from members. I actually support the concept of my colleague from Homer, but I guess out of deference to the need to fix kind of a short-term issue and the agreement that my colleague from Sitka has brokered, I guess I'm going to vote against it. I would be interested in further conversations about bringing this as a separate rules change, because I think it makes sense, notwithstanding the fact that effectively the speaker just completely controls that group anyway. And Representative Ledoux has a comment.
I thought Representative Millett was on the Committee on Committees last year. Now, the Committee on Committees met so infrequently,
right,
that I might be totally incorrect on that, but I thought she was on it last year.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Christ Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Ledoux, I think you might be right. So, the current configuration of Committee on Committees in the House may be effectively new. I'd be happy working with you, Representative Vance, to sort of run this idea up the trap line, if you will, really in both, you know, both bodies in the legislature. And I mean, this concurrent resolution next goes to judiciary. And I mean, if there were alignment from leadership on both sides, I would be fully supportive of incorporating the amendment.
Representative Vance.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Respectfully, isn't this process the running it through the trap line by being able to offer amendments and taking it through committees to get the input of the body? The reason I spoke with some other seniority, and I'm trying to think of the appropriate name to call the people who've been here longer than I have. And I did take your recommendation and call the former Speaker of the House to see, you know, oh, he had seven members, and I said, well, why did you have seven members? And he said, well, I had five from the majority and two from the minority. And, okay. The other reason that I would ask that we accept the amendment at this time is because when we're passing legislation or even making adjustments to our own rules, I think we should not just think about what's needed at this time, but think about the future when circumstances may change or, you know, for the next generation of leaders that would be here, of how we could make things better and not have to go back for them to fix what we could have taken care of at this time. So that's why I proposed it. If the committee decides that it's not acceptable at this time, then we can definitely try to move on something in the future. But if we start making all kinds of changes to uniform rules, I think everyone would get tired of us trying to mess with the rules. But I will respect the decision of the committee.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I've got a suggestion to make, because I realize, Representative Christ Thompson, that you're very much sympathetic to this amendment, as am I, and I actually think everybody in the committee is. Now, what we don't want to do is kill this resolution in the effort to, what's that phrase, you know, you don't want to...
Let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Let the perfect be the enemy of the good. So what about if we should pass this amendment here in this committee, and then you can go back to the leadership and say what has happened, and if it blows everything up, then this bill has another stop in judiciary, and we can deal with it in judiciary.
Representative Chris Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ledoux through the chair. I think sort of a good point. I mean, in any scenario, further conversations are warranted to see if we can incorporate this idea, which I think, to your point, a lot of us think makes sense. I'd rather sort of have conversations first before acting, and instead of sort of swapping that order, although I recognize potentially either could work. There's also absolutely zero rush on this resolution. If it died, things would continue to function. It's just a housekeeping measure. So, I mean, I think in light of this discussion, maybe what I would counter-propose or iterate on your proposal, Representative Ledoux, would be I have conversations with those in House and Senate leadership and see if there would be amenability to incorporating this amendment. And hoping there is, we could come back and amend it and take care of business.
And Representative Wool and Representative Shaw have comments or questions as well, but Representative Christ Hopkins, are you suggesting that we hold the bill today and not move forward? Okay. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support that decision as well. I don't really like doing stuff and saying, oh, we'll fix it in the next committee necessarily. I think running up the trap line or up the flagpole, whatever you want to call it, I mean, you can do some of that in committee, but if the amendment dies, it dies. And if the bill, by adding an amendment, dies later on, it's sometimes better to feel that out before you bring it all the way through a bunch of processes. I seem to recall my first 2 years in this institution, that when I was in the minority, that the Committee on Committees had minority members, maybe 5-2, I don't remember. But as you said, it's not really a policy committee. There's no rolling the chair. There's no, I mean, that's not the intent of that committee. It's more of a, I don't know what you call it. It doesn't meet very much, that's for sure. So I'm sort of agnostic on the whole thing. I think it's the call of the speaker. It's their committee from which they function to set up committees. It's not really supposed to be a big throwdown, drag out, debating type committee. So I think they had minority members on it as a courtesy. And I guess all you're really trying to do is saying we have 7. The rules say 5. So we just want to fix the rules so that. And I think 7. If I'm not mistaken, was the 5 of majority, and then I think at some point someone said we want a 2 minority come on to round it out a little bit, and that's maybe how they got the 7. I don't know.
Representative Shaw.
I was just going to suggest, since we're in the middle of debate on this, both sides one way or the other, that if we voted on it, it might make a difference. Where can we go with that? I mean, it sounds like there's no reason not to, and if we move it forward with or without, there's the benefit. If we move it with, then it can be taken out prior to. But if we don't take it today, will it be put back in a judiciary?
Representative Shaw, I think what Representative Christ-Tompkins suggested was that we actually not move the bill today. Representative Christ-Tompkins goes back to the respective leadership groups, asks about openness to this amendment, which if the amendment's not going to kill the bill, I totally support adding it. So I think we're all in the same place. And then we would add the language in this committee and then move it on to judiciary. So I guess maybe I would defer. First of all, you could have a follow-up, but I would also ask Representative Vance if she supports that plan of holding the bill, seeing if leadership is open to it. If it's not a poison pill, then we can add it and move it out of committee.
I just want to say thank you.
Representative Vance.
Yes, absolutely. I think that would be a perfectly, reasonable thing to do, and if the leadership says that no, it's a no-go, then I would just withdraw my amendment so that the bill can proceed.
Okay, well, it seems like we have consensus. So I don't see any public testimony online. Is anyone in the room to testify on HCR 4? Seeing none. It looks like we will hold this bill pending further discussion. Thank you, Representative Vance, for introducing, I think, a very positive concept. And seeing no other business before the committee, we're adjourned.